You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, all eyes on Kenya's Chief Justice as he begins hearing a petition that contests the recent election results that gave power to Uhuru Kenyatta. We'll be hearing a remarkable real-life story about seven dwarves, all of them siblings, all of whom survived the gas chambers of Auschwitz. We'll be talking to the authors and film director behind a powerful new book and documentary. And we'll hear why the real star of the Chinese president's recent trip to Russia may be his wife.
Within hours of Peng Liyuan stepping off the plane in Russia, photographs of her dressed in a demure black overcoat with a light blue scarf had gone viral in China.
And as one of Brazil's landmark stadiums for the 2014 World Cup faces indefinite closure, we assess what this means for the country's image globally.
It only reinforces negative stereotypes about Brazil, about its way of working, lack of transparency, poor administration, loads of negative prejudices, and some not even prejudices, facts.
All that, plus we spin some great music too, all to come here in the next hour, right here on Midori House. It's 1 minute past the hour here in London. Lots to come on the show tonight, but first let's catch up on the world headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The UK government has failed in its latest attempt to have the radical Muslim cleric Abu Qatada deported to Jordan to be tried on terrorism charges. The Court of Appeal has rejected Home Secretary Theresa May's attempt to overturn November's ruling, which allowed him to stay in Britain. The Home Office says it's determined to deport him and will be lodging a further appeal. Earlier this month, he was rearrested after a search of his London home. On March the 9th, he was sent back to prison for an alleged breach of his strict bail conditions. It's believed the Cyprus government may be about to impose a limit on the amount of money that can be taken out of the country. The development is reported in one of the island's national newspapers, the Katimarini. The central bank said the report was only based on draft proposals. Earlier, the chief executive of the Bank of Cyprus, the country's largest commercial lender, was dismissed by the central bank. Nearly 2,000 protesters have demonstrated outside the European Union House in Nicosia, demanding further action in protest against an EU bailout that'll see savings in Cypriot banks taxed. Among them was Andrea Kyriakou.
Why we are all angry? Because this is not Europe of solidarity. This is not Europe of support. This is not the Europe that we have all believed in, helping each other and supporting each other. We are all demonstrating here because of all these measures against Cypriot people, that we think that they are immoral, injustice, and we hope that the voice of the people will be heard loudly.
North Korea's foreign ministry says it will inform the United Nations Security Council that conditions for an imminent nuclear war have been created on the peninsula. The announcement came in a news bulletin on state television, which condemned what it called nuclear war provocation moves of the US and South Korean puppets. On Tuesday, Pyongyang announced that all its rocket and long-range artillery units were now on combat alert to target US military bases in the Pacific and on the mainland. It's also announced that it's cutting the military hotline with South Korea. The South has called for dialogue and aid for its neighbor to ease tensions. Japan is urging Pyongyang to stop its provocative actions. The former CIA director and Army General David Petraeus has publicly apologized for the extramarital affair that forced his resignation in November. His appearance at an event honoring University of Southern California veterans and Reserve Officers Training Corps students was his first public speech since his career was cut short by the scandal.
This has obviously been a very difficult episode for us. But perhaps my experience can be instructive to others who stumble or indeed fall as far as I did. One learns, after all, that life doesn't stop with such a mistake. It can and must go on. And the effort to move forward over the rocky path of one's own making is vital, inescapable, and ultimately worth it.
Tributes have been paid to a 14-year-old girl who died after she was attacked by a pack of dogs at a house in the north of England. Jade Anderson was found alone with five of the animals at a house she was visiting near the town of Wigan on Tuesday afternoon. Police, who've spoken to the owners but made no arrests, said armed officers destroyed four dogs. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. It's 18.05 in London, 21.05 in Nairobi, Kenya. This is Midori House, live on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. 5 years after a disputed vote unleashed widespread tribal violence across Kenya, the Supreme Court today began hearing a petition challenging Uhuru Kenyatta's victory in the recent election. Although that vote largely passed without violence and therefore went some way to restoring Kenya's reputation as a reasonably stable democracy, observers say the real test could still be to come. Will Kenyatta's rival, Raila Odinga, accept the Supreme Court's verdict, whatever it is, when it's passed this weekend? Tristan McConnell is Monocle's correspondent in Nairobi, and I spoke with him a little earlier, first of all, to get the context on what's happened recently in Kenya.
Well, we had the election in early March, which was provisionally won by Uhuru Kenyatta. He's now the president-elect, but his main opponent, Raila Odinga, has gone to the Supreme Court to challenge the election results, claiming that his opponent did not, in fact, get the 50% threshold that gives him a victory in the first round. So right now, there are petitions in the Supreme Court, and Supreme Court judges are assessing whether or not to validate the election results.
A lot of people have been talking about the failure of the technology in this election. What really were the grounds by which Odinga went to the Supreme Court?
Odinga's challenging the count, essentially. Now, the technological failure is the key one, is that there was supposed to be electronic transmission of results. And that was going to be a kind of a fail-safe, if you like, so that people could really trust the manual count of results, which was always the sort of the ultimate one that was going to be counted. And that failed entirely. I mean, it just didn't happen. And so his claim is essentially that votes were added to Uhuru Kenyatta's count and taken away from his between the polling centres and the main tally centre in Nairobi. So that's his argument. Of course, Uhuru Kenyatta completely rejects that at that point. But this is what Raila Odinga's lawyers are arguing at the Supreme Court, essentially that votes were added to the opponent and taken away from Raila Odinga.
There was a lot of widespread fear that we might see the sort of violence, the tribal violence that was unleashed the last time around. People were largely encouraged, I suppose, that violence didn't hit the streets. But is there any chance that if Odinga and his supporters don't get the verdict that they want this weekend, we could see that sort of bloodshed all over again in Kenya?
I think whichever way the Supreme Court judges rule, there's going to be anger and disappointment. If Uhuru Kenyatta's victory is rejected, then his supporters won't be happy with that. And obviously, if either Odinga's challenge is thrown out, then his supporters will be unhappy with that. And of course, there is always potential for political violence, given the history of that here in Kenya. But where we can take comfort is that both political leaders have said that they will abide by the Supreme Court ruling. And so that would one can expect that will diffuse any potential for violence this time around.
So to what extent is Kenya's reputation as one of Africa's most stable democracies restored by the events of the past few weeks?
I think we're not quite there yet. Certainly the election day itself was very largely peaceful, and the behaviour of political leaders on all sides since then has been very good. But we're not out of the woods yet. We really have to wait for the Supreme Court ruling, which is due, we're told, on Saturday, to say that Kenya has sort of laid to rest the ghosts of the 2007 election and can move forward as once again a sort of a bastion of stability in Africa.
All eyes at the moment on Chief Justice Willy Mutunga. Tell us more about this figure. He's quite controversial. Some people have been saying that he's too close to Odinga to really be impartial. What are your thoughts?
I think Willy Mutunga has a great deal of widespread public support, both among ordinary folk, also among politicians and among the donor community. He's seen as a kind of stand-up guy, someone who won't be swayed. And yes, there was this issue where he's been quoted in the past as saying that he thought Odinga was the man for the job, but that was quite a few years ago now, before he became the Chief Justice. So I think he still does enjoy a great deal of widespread support, and that's going to be very critical when we go towards the Supreme Court judgment, probably at the weekend.
Is it fair to say that Kenya's rather discredited judicial system is in a better state now under Mutunga?
It certainly is, and his appointment is part of the beginnings of reform in Kenya. We had a new constitution which was voted in a couple of years ago, and really the only major reform that's been put in place since then is in the judiciary. We've got a whole new set of judges, they've all been vetted. We're supposed to see similar reforms in the police service and elsewhere, but it's really only in the judiciary that we've seen those reforms kind of take root, and that has given people a great deal of optimism, really, that we can get through this last stage of the election process without any repeat of the kind of political violence that we saw in 2007, 2008.
Tristan, just give us your prediction around what might happen over the weekend. You've said that both leaders of the parties have called for accepting the judgments, but do you think their supporters will be content with that? Will they be confident enough? Or are we likely to see a spillover of the sort of violence that we've seen in the past?
Their supporters are not going to be content, whichever side loses. As I said, they're going to be very disappointed. There'll certainly be some anger there. But everything really hangs on the behaviour of the political leaders. If they reject the ruling of the Supreme Court and order their people into the streets, then we're going to have trouble. But there's no indication at the moment they're going to do that. And certainly the sense I picked up during the sort of long wait for election results a few weeks ago was that, you know, both sides, winners and losers, just wanted to get on with their lives again. You know, they just wanted to put the election behind them, put the violence of 2007, 2008 behind them and get on. So it's hard to call at the moment, but I think if Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta both, call for calm and accept the results, then Kenya's going to be okay. The kind of violence is not going to recur. If they reject it, then we're in trouble.
That was Tristan McConnell, our correspondent in Nairobi. Coming up on Midori House, a look at China's stylish First Lady and an extraordinary story of survival in Auschwitz against quite unimaginable odds.
The beautifully turned out April issue of Monocle includes our new spring style directory, which takes a look at the best retail projects around the globe, the new shopping neighbourhoods, why Jakarta is on the fashion map, and how the Swiss make the watch world tick. We also take a visit to Tokyo Hands, the famous Japanese store where you can buy everything you didn't know you needed. And we have lots more in this issue too.
In the affairs section, we head to the Turkey-Syria border to discover what NATO is and isn't doing in Syria. We visit the largest Finnish community outside the Nordic region. It's in Canada. And we also meet a woman you might remember, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection.
In the business section, we take a sniff at the scent industry. We send our Paris correspondent south to Grasse to find out how the Provençal town is becoming a hub for high-tech innovation. And we introduce a new section, Master and Apprentice. In the first instalment, we profile a man who started tailoring aged 11.
In culture, we ask how you renovate and rebrand one of the world's greatest museums. We visit Amsterdam's Estimable Rijksmuseum to see what a 10-year sabbatical teaches you. We also investigate high turnover tales in the world of the art postcard and just for a minute give in to the allure of the average, courtesy of our Culture Ed's column.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to join the club.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we hear from design critic Alice Rawsthorne about her new book, Hello World. We review the London Design Museum's Designs of the Year exhibition, and we pay a visit to Le Corbusier's only built project in the Americas, a house outside Buenos Aires.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:15 in London, 02:15 a.m. in Beijing. Fashion icon, singer, married to a president. Sound familiar? Well, move on over, Carla Bruni, because there's a new first lady in town. Peng Liyuan, wife of the new Chinese president Xi Jinping, last week stepped off a plane in Moscow and promptly caused a media frenzy. Although widely expected to boost her husband's popularity due to her star status, what do we really know about the new First Lady of China? Monocle's Justin Bergman tells us more.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is in the midst of his first overseas trip as the leader of the world's most populous country. But he isn't the one generating the headlines back home. His fashion-forward wife is. Within hours of Peng Liyuan stepping off the plane in Russia, photographs of her dressed in a demure black overcoat with a light blue scarf had gone viral in China. The maker of the outfit was instantly identified as a domestic brand called Exception, and the company's website subsequently crashed from the spike in traffic. It was a Kate Middleton moment in a country where first ladies have historically tended to be either bland or invisible. Peng is neither of those two things. In fact, the 50-year-old former folk singer was once one of the country's biggest celebrities. Some say she is still more famous in China than her bureaucrat husband. The glamorous Peng, whose name means great beauty in Chinese, made her name as a performer in the annual Spring Festival Gala on Chinese television, an event watched by hundreds of millions of people. For 25 years, she appeared in flowing silk ball gowns with pageant show hair to sing such Communist Party classics as My Wonderful Hometown and I Belong to China. She gave up the stage, however, when her husband began rising in the political ranks, and most analysts expected her to remain out of sight as First Lady. This isn't turning out to be the case, however. Judging by the reaction she's received back home on her current trip to Russia and Africa, the Chinese public is starved for a First Lady with some style and personality, a Chinese answer to Michelle Obama. Peng's softer image could prove to be beneficial to a Communist Party increasingly seen as out of touch with the younger generation. But don't expect her to be picking up a microphone and belting out one of her old standbys in Africa this week. The party will likely manage her star power carefully so she doesn't outshine her husband, which could prove embarrassing for the new president. She'll also be sure to avoid wearing flashy designer labels, which could damage the central government's stated aim of reigning in corruption. But Peng's presence on the president's first overseas trip does signal a change in the official attitude toward the role of the First Lady in China. We'll be seeing a lot more of Peng in the future, that much is certain. For Monocle in Singapore, I'm Justin Bergman.
Well, on that note, I think we should have a little musical interlude from China now. This is Meng Tian, and it's exactly the same.
Different to those days when I saw you living in a other world. I couldn't get your way of thinking. Until I was in the same situation, making same choices just like yours. Everything you say, I approve, I agree, I understand now. Sitting right across from you after all this time.
That was Meng Tian with Exactly the Same.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu é Monocle 24.
Para London, dette er Monocle 24. From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
It's 23 minutes past the hour here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Now, you might think that if a group of people had lived on land for generations, they might have something to say about its prospective sale for development to companies from overseas, especially if the land in question is a few million hectares of pristine, unspoiled Amazon rainforest. But that's precisely what's not happened, according to critics of a plan by Ecuador to auction the land to Chinese oil firms who are, understandably, keen to harness the natural resources beneath the surface. Ecuador's ambassador to China says this is a win-win situation and will create mutual benefits for the two nations. Indigenous groups, however, are not convinced, and nor are environmental campaigners. Well, joining me on the line now is Adam Zuckerman, environmental and human rights campaigner for Amazon Watch. Adam, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me, Clemency.
So just give us the picture here. Ecuador is planning to auction off more than 3 million pristine hectares of Amazonian rainforest to Chinese oil companies. Is there any positive spin that can be gleaned from this?
I think one issue with this is that all seven indigenous nationalities who live in the area, who in many cases have lived there for thousands of years, are in opposition to this oil route. They've signed a declaration that they've sent to the Ecuadorian government in opposition. There have been protests in Quito, in Houston, Texas, in Paris, and the only reason why there wasn't a protest in China was because, they would have been locked up for many years.
Hmm.
I think one major issue with this is that Ecuador has essentially sold its sovereignty to China in order to continue financing oil extraction.
Well, I was just going to say that Ecuador is by no means the only country in the world to be leveraging itself, to sort of selling itself to China, would you say? Tell us about the sort of relationship that exists between the two countries.
Right. In the past, Ecuador has defaulted many times on its credit. So China is essentially the only lender that's willing to lend to Ecuador. So Ecuador has to give up a lot of its sovereignty, a lot of its environmental protections, a lot of its, it has a really beautiful constitution that gives actually rights to Mother Nature. It's one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. The problem with that is that the Correa government, when it comes to indigenous rights and environmental rights, is not living up to that constitution, in large part because it's getting pressure from the Chinese in order to keep receiving funds to finance a $12 billion refinery on the coast, to finance other projects. It's giving up a lot of those protections, without the input of indigenous communities who would be most affected.
Well, tell us more about those indigenous communities. What sort of lifestyle, what sort of livelihood is now under threat? And have the Ecuadorian government put any sorts of safeguards on their lifestyle?
Right. So the Ecuadorian government says that they've done a consultation process. The problem with the consultation process that they've done is that many of the communities are in such opposition to this oil round that they have not actually allowed the Ecuadorian government into their territories. So there has really, in reality, been no way to do a consultation process. As they've learned from the past, a lot of the times the government or oil companies will trick communities into agreeing to projects with bribes, with getting one community member to be on board and saying that the entire community has agreed. And there's sort of this new legal standard that was developed by last year at the Inter-American Court of Human Rights called FPIC, which means free prior informed consent. The Ecuadorian government lost a case against the Quichua community of Sarayaku for allowing an oil company to drill to explore their land without their permission and for leaving tons of dynamite on their land that to this day exists.
I'm looking at a map.
There's actually a great film coming out about that that Amnesty International is making with that community called Children of the Jaguar.
I'm looking at a map, Adam, of the the space where the oil exploration blocks will take place, and it seems enormous. What kind of scale of devastation do you think we're talking about if these plans go ahead? Yeah, environmental devastation, that is. I'm sure it could be argued that it's not going to create devastation, but just supposing that we take it at face value that some kind of environmental degradation will take place.
Right. I think if what's happened in the northern Ecuadorian Amazon is any clue, it'll be devastating to communities. As you may have heard, there's been a $19 billion ruling against Chevron for dumping 16 billion gallons of toxic wastewater in the northern Ecuadorian Amazon that poisoned tens of thousands of people. So that's sort of been the Ecuadorian government's record on regulation around these companies. So these communities, which have trapped a lot of the leaders from the southern Ecuadorian Amazon, have traveled to the northern Ecuadorian Amazon, have seen how a lot of the rainforest there is contaminated, is destroyed, people don't have clean drinking water, and their lifestyle is hunting and gathering, fishing, essentially living off of the land in a clean, pristine environment. And it's actually the area that is up for grabs with this oil auction right now, that's on the chopping block, is one of the most biodiverse places in the world. It's said that it has the same biodiversity as the Yasuni National Park, which has been called the most biodiverse place on the planet. And for every hectare in Yasuni, it has as much biodiversity as all of North America.
Well, that is a staggering thought. Adam Zuckerman, sadly, we're going to have to leave it there. Environmental and human rights campaigner for Amazon Watch. Fascinating stuff, and I'm sure this will continue to be a debate as China extends its influence around the world. But thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24 tonight. In the next half hour of the programme, we will be looking into how Brazil is getting ready or not for the World Cup and the Olympics, and we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Italy from a children's book fair in Bologna. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The UK government has failed in its latest attempt to have the radical Muslim cleric Abu Qatada deported to Jordan to be tried on terrorism charges. The Court of Appeal rejected Home Secretary Theresa May's attempt to overturn November's ruling, which allowed him to stay in Britain. The Home Office says it's determined to deport him and will be lodging a further appeal. It's believed the Cyprus government may be about to impose a limit on the amount of money that can be taken out of the country. The development is reported in one of the island's national newspapers, the Katimarini. The central bank said the report was only based on draft proposals. Earlier, the chief executive of the Bank of Cyprus, the country's largest commercial lender, was dismissed by the central bank. North Korea's foreign ministry says it will inform the United Nations Security Council that conditions for an imminent nuclear war have been created on the peninsula. The announcement came in a news bulletin on state television, which condemned what it called nuclear war provocation moves of the US and South Korean puppets. The former CIA director and Army General David Petraeus has publicly apologised for the extramarital affair that forced his resignation in November. His appearance at an event honouring University of Southern California veterans and Reserve Officers Training Corps students was his first public speech since his career was cut short by the scandal. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, 32 minutes past the hour here in London. Now, the phrase survival of the fittest has rarely been more poignant than during the Holocaust, when to be physically disabled, let alone physically disabled and Jewish, was a double misfortune that few could survive.
And how many people would be here?
About 3,000.
Wow.
From six villages. They thought they will be taken to labor camps.
So if you tried to leave?
Shooting on the spot.
Really? Uh-huh.
They mock them. They mock them. They consider them as luggage. That's the word in Hungarian. Okay, the luggage is arrived at Dragomirest and they have to be thrown out of the cart.
I don't know what to say about that.
How extraordinary, then, to learn of a single family of seven siblings, all of them dwarfs, all under 3 feet tall, all of whom survived the gas chambers of Auschwitz. Well, with me here in the studio at Midori House is Ursula McFarlane, the award-winning director of the new television documentary from which we just heard that clip. And joining us down the line from Jerusalem is Eilat Negev, one of the authors of a new book about the extraordinary Ovitz family. Very warm welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Eilat, I'm going to start with you. It's such an extraordinary story. Tell us more about the Ovitz family and how you found out about them.
Well, the Ovitz family came from Transylvania, and in the 1930s and 1940s, they had a theater group called the Lilliput Troupe. There were five sisters and two brothers. All, like you said, they're under 3 feet tall, and actually they are the largest recorded family of dwarfs ever recorded. And what's interesting about them that they, first and foremost, they were artists, even before being dwarfs, before being Jewish, and their attitude dictated their survival. And my partner, Yehuda Koren, and I, just saw a line, quite a footnote in a history book saying something about a Lilliput troop which was in the early days of Israel, and we were quite surprised and started to dig, and luckily we found the last surviving member of the siblings, Perla Ovitz. But that was really at the beginning of a very long journey. Then we interviewed dozens of other survivors and of other people who had seen them, and doctors and inmates, and we thought that it would be a Holocaust story, but actually it's about dwarves as entertainers and people who were very proud to be what they were and never ashamed, not of their dwarfism and, of course, not of their Jewishness.
Ursula, you have chosen to tell this really remarkable story through a very powerful narrator, Warwick Davis, who is himself a dwarf and an entertainer. I know you filmed in Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that experience and why it was important, do you think, to have an actor like Warwick and a dwarf himself to really ram home what should have been the fate of this extraordinary family?
Yeah, well, I mean, Warwick is a very empathetic, kind, sort of sensitive human being, as well as being a very short man. And I think it was really important to go on that journey with someone who could, you know, so to speak, put himself in the shoes of again, those little people. And in fact, Warwick is at least a foot taller than the members of the Ovitz family, which, you know, I mean, Warwick is very small, so you can just imagine. And there were sort of situations that we'd be in. For example, we went to the train station where they got on the train. They were forced onto the train, which took them eventually to Auschwitz. And this wasn't even a cattle truck. It was a normal train. And Warwick couldn't get on the train without help. And we, you know, our guide was saying that the cattle train that they'd have got on was at least the step was a foot higher even. So you can imagine the, you know, the physical ardour, the difficulty of this small family getting around. So I think having Warwick there sort of was very poignant, because it allowed you to not only think about what happened to them, but also actually physically see what it was like to have been them.
The Nazis, of course, under the Action T4 euthanasia program, were setting out specifically to kill people who were physically or mentally disabled, added to which this family were all, obviously, they were Jews. Tell us more about what happened to them when they got to Auschwitz and how it was that they could possibly have survived given that double fate.
Yes, they arrived at Auschwitz in May 1944 with 3,000 other people from the village and the other villages, and most of these people were sent immediately to the gas chamber. And somehow one of the soldiers spotted them, saw these seven dwarfs and some of their family members who were of average height, and he told them to step aside. And he went to get Dr. Mengele. Now, Dr. Mengele, the angel of death, the notorious Nazi doctor, He was using, of course, he was most of the time he was selecting people to death, but he was also using the time to find twins and to find people who were physically deformed or genetically impaired. And the moment that he saw these seven dwarfs and the larger family, he understood that he's going to have a research niche. And he said, now I have worked for 20 years. And he put them aside and he gave them better conditions to them and to the people who were with them. And by his crooked interest in them, because he wanted to conduct experiments on them, that's how he looked after them. And of course they had very harsh conditions, but it was much better than the other people, and so they managed to survive. So his interest in them actually survived them, had them survive. And Perla was always ambivalent about Mengele. She said, on one hand, of course, he was the devil.
Jump in. Perla Ovitz was the survivor of the family who you met and interviewed at length for the book and is in the film.
Yes. And she said that, you know, that she, on one hand, of course, she knew that he was a devil, but on the other hand, she owed him her life. She said, I was saved by the devil. And she even said that if he ever was caught, she wouldn't want him to be hanged because she couldn't, and only God can do it. And she owed him her life.
Asilia, it's extraordinary to think that there are still aspects of the Holocaust and of that period of history that can be so revelatory. That's certainly how I felt when I watched the film, when I read the book. We're so used to hearing these stories, and this truly seemed to offer a different dimension on the Holocaust. How did you approach it as a filmmaker?
Well, I think, you know, as we said earlier, I think having the you know, someone so kind of engaging and charming and sensitive as Warwick was the way in to tell the story, because, you know, unfortunately, we've seen so many of those images of Auschwitz and, you know, the terrible pictures of people being deported. And I think it just felt to me that it's a terrible word, you know, fatigue, that sort of idea that we get bored almost, or perhaps immune to seeing the power of those images anymore. But I think this was, you know, I felt, and Warwick felt, that this was a way to bring that story to a completely different audience, because he is a big star and people would tune in to see him. And so you had that immediate sort of engagement with the audience. But it's such an extraordinary story. And I think the magical number of seven, the seven dwarfs, every child knows that story. You know, that brought the audience in. And I think we then felt we could tell a serious story through bringing it in a way that was engaging. And we also, you know, we were very interested in the idea of the fairy tale, you know, the legend, the Grimm's fairy tale of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which obviously became a really big film in 1937. And in fact, it was Hitler's favourite film. Mm. So there's this sort of very strange background to it, that, you know, people were fascinated in dwarfs, and obviously Nazis became fascinated in dwarfs. So we were able to play, if you like, on all those kind of layers of, you know, fairy tale that was real, but also was actually a very dark, dark and dangerous fairy tale.
You interview in the film other Holocaust survivors, other Auschwitz survivors, including an extraordinary cellist called Anita Walfisch, who was also, in a sense, an entertainer at Auschwitz. How compromising was that? What did they have to do? Did they, as well as being, you know, tests and guinea pigs for Mengele, did they have to perform? Did they have to go through the trauma of that?
Well, that, I mean, it's a very interesting question, and probably Alat should come in here. I think there's a real ambivalence there, because I think Perla, am I right, Alat, said that she never performed for the Nazis, but other witnesses say different. So, is Alat still here?
And of course, it's incredibly difficult always, I suppose, oral histories. I know historians, Alat, you make the point that it's always difficult normally in normal circumstances to just go on oral histories when you're writing a history book. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I cannot recommend highly enough this book, Giants, The Dwarfs of Auschwitz, by Alat Negev. Thank you very much for joining us from Jerusalem. Alat and Ursula McFarlane here in the studio in London. It's 1842. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York,
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
On Gardelorne.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Daniel.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monaco. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monaco 24. Monaco 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is 18:43 in London, 15:43 in Rio de Janeiro, where Brazil's stadium woes are, I'm afraid to say, getting worse. The Maracanã, the stunning, evocative yet crumbling concrete bowl in Rio that's due to host some of the biggest World Cup matches, is racing against time to be ready for its grand opening in June. And now the city's other stadium, built just 6 years ago and once considered the most modern sporting venue in Latin America, has been closed indefinitely until repairs have been carried out on its leaking roof. Infrastructure, from airports to roads to stadiums, was always going to be Brazil's biggest problem. But to discuss how serious these latest setbacks are, Steve Bloomfield sat down earlier with Monocle's regular Brazil contributor Bruno Garces and Monocle 24 researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Bruno, first of all, we should just point out that you're from Rio. And Fernando, you're a Sao Paulo native.
Exactly.
So I'm fairly sure we'll get on to sort of whether Sao Paulo and Rio are doing better. But Bruno, let's talk about Rio's problems, and in particular the stadium, the João Havelange Stadium. What's gone wrong?
Well, yes, there was the intervention now that in the stadium, which is known to us as Engenhão, which is in the outskirts of Rio, it has suffered intervention because of cracks in its structure, which is a bit scandalous given that this stadium has been built only a few years ago. So for it already to be having problems. On top of that, you have the majestic, once majestic Maracanã that you mentioned. I've watched several games there, and to me it was like entering a Roman arena. It was watching like going to the Colosseum. It was toned down a bit. It doesn't have the same capacity that it once had. It was once.
I mean, it was 200,000 at its height, which was, it was the biggest stadium in the world.
In the world, yes.
And you guys filled it.
Well, yes. In 1950, it was over the capacity. And
do you really want to talk about 1950?
We'll which skip is that.
A
we'll
bad
skip
moment
that.
For Brazilian football. Yes, but anyway, let's skip that.
Yeah, but bad omen apart, and now it's having its capacity reduced. But the works are a bit behind. You know, you have striker Romário, who's currently a congressman, is one of those calling for a serious auditioning of what's going on, because he says that all the works are delayed and there's, according to him, lots of money being deviated for its original purposes. This, although Engenhão, the stadium, wasn't going to be to serve as to host any games of the World Cup, it's obviously raises concerns, fairly so.
Indeed, Fernando, when we look at the problems that Brazil's, or the challenges that Brazil has ahead of this sort of big 3 years, the World Cup in 2014, the Rio Olympics in 2016, do you get the impression that there are enough people within positions of power in Brazil who understand the seriousness of what needs to be done?
I think they should really get serious, but I have a feeling that in Brazil we tend to do things very last minute. So I have the feeling that, for example, when it is 2014, 2 months before the World Cup, I mean, everybody's going to run. And actually, they're doing that with airports as well. I'm not sure if our airports will be ready for the amount of tourists. So I don't know if you read about that, Bruno, but they are planning to do like airports that are just going to be there just for the World Cup. So kind of provisory
pop
airports.
Pop-up airports.
Pop-ups airports. And I'm not joking, Steve, you know?
Wow. And, okay, that'll
and,
be
you know,
interesting.
Talking a little bit about my hometown, actually. You know, the stadium of in São Paulo, the Itaquerão, actually, there might be some problems. It's supposedly to be the opening match of the World Cup over there, but they're having Brasília as a plan B. So we always need a plan B, actually.
You always need a plan B.
Well, exactly. Or C as well.
Or a plan C as well. Bruno, when we look at this, is there... I mean, obviously, there's still there's a lot of competition between Rio and São Paulo. You know, the way that the cities are, the way they've always been traditionally. Do you think that sort of rivalry is actually going to help ahead of the World Cup in trying to spur people on to be like, well, we don't want to be the ones that let everyone else down?
In theory, it should. But apparently, the saddest aspect of it all is that both cities
victories are disappointing. Well, I was just off the air. I was just talking to Fernando, and we were looking at a story that the Itaquerão, which is the new stadium being built in a somewhat downridden area of São Paulo, which would be a good thing to have a stadium there. The works are also behind because there's a problem with financing the stadium. That was why, as you just said, Brasília might be a plan B to the opening of the games. And there's also another aspect, which is if Brazil doesn't do too well in the qualifying, I mean, we might not even see Brazil playing in the Maracanã itself, given that it is only to host the finals. I mean, knock on wood.
Don't say that, Bruno and Air. Don't say that. Okay.
Well, let's leave Brazil's sort of on-pitch woes to one side. Fernando, there's also an issue about cats, isn't there?
Big problem as well, Steve.
Explain the issue with cats.
Well, you know, around the area of the Maracanã Stadium, there was like about 150 cats living there, and they always live there. It's a traditional thing in the area. And there's a lot of volunteers who give food away, but now, actually, the volunteers, they can't give food to the cats anymore because, you know, they're closing the Senão, you can't give food to the cats. And it's been quite a big problem. And a security officer even told one of the volunteers, you should throw the food over the wall. That's quite sad. Apparently, the company organized said that the people who work there, they are feeding the cats, but I'm not sure. Big problem as well.
So cats, leaking roofs, crumbling stadiums, pop-up airports. But you're still confident, aren't you, that everything's going to be fine-ish?
Yeah, hopefully, as Fernando mentioned, in the foreseeable future, it will.
I mean, just on a serious note, I mean, do you find it frustrating, Bruno, that all the discussions ahead of this are about, ooh, can Brazil do this?
Yeah, it is a disappointment. I mean, it only reinforces negative stereotypes about Brazil, about its way of working, and on dealings with corruption, with lack of transparency, poor administration. It reinforces loads of negative prejudices, and some not even prejudices, facts.
That was our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield speaking to Monocle contributor Bruno Garces and our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco a little earlier on, talking about the challenges facing Brazilians ahead of the 2014 World Cup. Next on Midori House, we're off to Bologna for the Children's Book Fair. To get us in the right vibe for a bit of literature, here's Beth Ditto with I Wrote the Book. That was Beth Ditto with I Wrote the Book. Very fitting. You're listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and we're about to turn a fresh page now. We're heading over to Bologna, scene of the 50th edition of the famous book fair for the children and young adults market. 1,200 exhibitors with more than 1,000 from outside Italy, including publishing houses big and small, all jockeying for position and bidding to auction off the rights to their bestsellers to markets near and far. Monocle's Ivan Carvalho has been cracking spines and scanning pages in pursuit of the next big thing, and he joins me down the line now. Hi, Ivan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell us a bit more about Bologna's Children's Book Fair and how significant this is in terms of the literary market in general.
Yeah, this is the biggest event for children's publishing. And I have to say I was quite surprised at how vibrant the market is in this age of digital and apps and all these other options now, ebooks, that print is very strong, especially for young children, picture books. So it was quite good feeling walking around seeing a lot of illustrators presenting their books and pitching to publishers. So it was definitely print is very much alive.
Well, that's very heartening for those of us who care about real books. Do you have a sense of how children's books are holding up in sales against ebooks?
Yeah, it's interesting. While in a lot of markets, whether it's in the Americas or in Europe, have seen significant drops. India happens to be a bright spot. But while there have been significant drops, say like in the U.S., almost in, I think, double digits. The children's books have really resisted in a lot of markets. And when I say children's books, we're talking more about sort of the 2 to 5 year olds. Of course, young adults, there's that's also quite strong because there's a lot of also crossover. I was talking to someone at Bloomsbury, of course, Bloomsbury from the UK, the ones that launched Harry Potter.
I was going to say, they famously published a series about a wizard, did they not?
And they were saying it was interesting. You know, they were looking also at their ebook sales, and they were wondering, we weren't sure that they're not sure about who's downloading. Is it people that are, you know, parents for their children, or also could be parents who want to read themselves? You know, because with Harry Potter there was that sort of crossover appeal. Mm-hmm. It started, and then we had, you know, the Hunger Games also, and then with Twilight. So there's a lot of those out there, and there's a lot of, you know, publishers out there pitching and auctioning off stories.
Well, it's a way of saving face, I suppose. If you're going to read Twilight, you may as well do it on a Kindle so that no one actually can see your shame if you're an adult. Tell us about the sorts of trends. Are we seeing lots more vampires and supernatural types of, you know, the sorts of titles you've just mentioned?
We, in terms of young adults, you do see sci-fi witches. There are going to be some witches coming out. There's going to be a witch trilogy. The Witch Mothers trilogy is going to be something that we're going to see next year in 2014. But also more literary stories. I was talking to this company from San Francisco, Chronicle Books, who won an award, and they were pitching a book called We Could Be Heroes. That's about a boy and a girl, one in East Berlin, one in West Berlin. And they were very enthused about this. They think it's going to win some awards. And they were even quite surprised that they were pitching it to publishers in Germany. And they were positive on it. They were surprised that there was actually great interest there. So there's a bit of everything. It's quite interesting.
It's clearly a huge, huge market and a massive fair. You know, 1,200 exhibitors is a lot, 1,100 of which are from outside Italy. Is there a sense of discrepancy between what, say, European publishing houses are after, what US publishers are looking for?
In terms of the market, I talked to an illustrator, Stephen Guarnaccia, who teaches at Parsons in New York and is an illustrator. He does children's books as well. And he was saying, when you look at the market in the U.S., for example, it's very much, you know, market-driven. So they're looking at sort of like a blockbuster film. They want something they can really sell and in volume get a big machine behind it in terms of advertising and publicity, and also for selling maybe toys and other things, like, say, something like a Cars movie, where when you look at, say, in Europe, the illustrators sort of drive the market. So editors want to work with illustrators and then maybe work around them and their style, their graphic style, to maybe tell a story. And I saw a lot of that. There was from French publishing houses to this small one in Portugal, Planeta Tangerina, and their story about, it's called The Island in English, and it's about how visitors from the mainland come to an island, and the islanders want to become like the mainlanders, and basically it's a story of development and how the island gets ruined and the resources. But the graphics are really strong, the illustrations almost like sort of sketches you might see from Miro or something, and so there's two different markets. So the U.S. market's kind of like the blockbuster Hollywood film, and then maybe in Europe it's sort of like the indie market, let's say.
Ivan, we're always hearing about how, you know, the publishing industry is on its knees and how children don't want to read books anymore. Very, very quickly, did you come out of there with a positive note?
I'm a parent of a 2-year-old who loves to read books, and it's, of all the options I have, whether it's, you know, putting on a DVD or something on YouTube or apps on a tablet, sitting down and reading with my child is the most pleasurable because it's very tactile. You turn the page, there's a surprise, you know, what's on the next page. And the child really can follow a story, and their parents, there have been studies, and this was also talked about at the fair, that parents, you know, they say the child can focus better on this story, this arc of the story, turning the pages, whereas with an app there's a lot of distractions and touching and things moving and graphics and visuals and all that. And so I think, especially for young kids from up to 2 to 6, it's still very much strong.
Well, that is music to our ears here at Monocles. We're a great believer in the power of the printed word. Ivan, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Ivan Carvalho. That's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to our producers, Tom Edwards, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabel Bly, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. Thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. all add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.